and her writing, Standoff. You can get a copy of Standoff for a $60 or more contribution. We'll work out the details. Just get your contribution in. And
I'll sign it too.
And she'll sign it. And I'm not sure how we will work out all those details, but we'll do it. You can get in touch with the station through our website. KBO.FM, donate, please. We need your support. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody who has supported and is going to. Bye, everybody.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
At its core, democracy itself means rule by the people. KBOO exists to give a voice to all of the people in our community, not the business with the most dollars to spend. If you feel like sharing your love of democracy and your love of KBOO, get the limited edition KBOO Sounds of Democracy t-shirt. Designed by our fantastic graphic designer, Michelle Moss. You can order yours right now at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee will meet on Wednesday, October 13th at 6 p.m. instead of the second Monday of this month. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify a meeting is being held.
Today on Wings, more of our interview with Professor Ellen Balka, founder and director of the Assessment of Technology in Context Design Lab.
Anyway, if you take seriously this notion that technology reflects the values of the society in which it's produced, I think a logical extension of that is maybe we should try and make that process conscious.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. I first used computers for work in the 1970s when I learned a series of typesetting systems that quickly disappeared, forcing me to throw away what I had learned and start all over. 50 years later, I'm forced to unlearn my efficient computer habits and retrain on a newer model that does all sorts of surprising things I really don't wish it to do. Is anyone working on reducing human stress and waste of time in the face of technology change? Ellen Balka is. She founded the Assessment of Technology in Context Design Lab back in 1997 at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and is still its director. Wings Radio listeners heard part one of our interview last week. Here's what else the professor told me.
Professor Balka, may I ask you a question about the field of nursing and how technology has affected nursing? Because I know many women who are nurses who have actually left the field, they're trained nurses who've left the field because they felt like the relationship to the patient had changed so much due to technology. Can you kind of describe what the recent changes have been and say how this affects the field more broadly?
Certainly, I'll make a few comments about that, but I also want to do a plug for a former master's student of mine named Zena Sharman, who actually wrote her master's thesis, an excellent piece of work about that very topic. So I want to credit Zena with some of the insights that I'm going to share with you. Zena did a really interesting piece of work looking at the intersection of gender technology and caring amongst nurses in the emergency department at Vancouver General Hospital. And one of the things that, and again, she did an observationally based study complemented by interviews with nurses as well as unit clerks. And one of the things that she found is, and there is a whole literature about this, is that for nurses, nursing and care providing for, you know, many, if not most nurses, is fundamental. It's about caring. And for nurses, caring is a very tactile thing. It's about touching patients. In fact, touch is a very, very important aspect of nursing assessment. You know, you touch somebody to assess their body temperature, to feel their pulse, to you use touch in an awful lot of ways as a nurse, as part of your diagnostic and assessment skill. So the introduction of technology into nursing work presents, in fact, many contradictions, because on the one hand, it's introduced with an eye towards improving care. But on the other hand, it often mediates between the nurse's tactile experience of a patient and the patient. So it's often a physical thing that, you're interacting with the technology rather than directly with the patient.
So now, instead of taking a pulse by hand, you're slapping on a little electrode or something, or instead of taking a temperature by touch, you're sticking something in the patient's ear that does the readout really quickly.
Both of those things would be true, and one of the challenges that you have as a nurse is you still need to maintain, of course, all your tactily based skills, because you also now need to know when the technology is giving you a bad reading, for example. So you need to be able to recognize when the patient you observe, who's sitting next to you, presents differently than what the machine tells you to do. So you're now not only responsible for assessing the patient, but you also have to be on top of assessing essentially the functionality of the machine. And so there are a lot of contradictions there. One of the other things, I want to go back to Zena Sharman's work for a moment. One of the other things that Zena found is that nurses, in fact, made a distinction between two types of technologies that were introduced into health sector work. Technologies that they viewed as administrative, which they tended to distance themselves from. So something like, for example, an electronic patient record might be seen as an administrative technology, and technologies that were more geared towards sort of direct care of the patient. So an example of that might be a dialysis machine, an IV pump, so on. And they had very different kinds of relationships with those two technologies. So they tended to have a degree of facility with, their nurses are amazing. Actually, they're just amazing at getting done what needs to get done under any circumstance. They are just phenomenal. So for a nurse, I've observed this many times, if a nurse is working with a machine and something's not quite working, either she'll know how to jerry-rig it or do whatever needs to be done to get it to function as it needs to, or she'll go to the nurse next to her who will know how to do that. And there's this wonderful kind of sharing of tacit knowledge about how to make sure all the equipment is functioning quite well. But what Zena found is that although the nurses would do that with what they viewed as the clinical technologies, they tended to not do that with the administrative technologies, which they really kind of considered outside of their domain.
So in other words, if something went wrong with the record keeping, they just let the record go to hell?
Well, they can't let the record go to hell, but it was quite interesting that they didn't tend to kind of jump in and try and solve problems, say, with the electronic patient record system, where they would with an IV pump. Mm-hmm. And that was quite interesting. I have my own theories about part of why that is. Historically, obviously both nursing and clerical work have been women's work, but they're valued in different ways in our society. And there's, even within women's work, there's a hierarchy of of types of job. And so I think part of it was possibly nurses wanting to distance themselves for what is unfortunately often considered lower status work of clerical work.
Yeah, like I went to nursing school so I didn't have to learn typing kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, there are a lot of contradictions there as well.
But then there's something else going on here too, which is that typing, for instance, is a job that used to be done by specialists, and they were women specialists and perhaps undervalued. But now, if you look at how typesetting has disappeared and how so many things, in other words, everyone's expected, because of the computers, to do a lot of typing that they might not have had to do otherwise.
That's absolutely true, and it's quite interesting. I mean, the average age of a nurse in British Columbia now is about 49 years old, and so anybody who's about 49 years old has more likely than not gone through school with computers. And so one of the real challenges that the health sector faces as a sector is that we have a labor force populated by people who haven't necessarily grown up, who largely haven't grown up with computers, who probably haven't necessarily had time to work with computers, and because of the gender dynamics of home computer use, which is a whole other story, we won't even go there today, you know, lots of women live in houses with computers and don't have opportunities to use them. So you have this labor force that all of a sudden is having all this new technology introduced. There's lots of typing involved, lots of you know, basic computer skills required, and you have a population that does not necessarily have those skills. It's a huge undertaking to try and get the labor force trained to the point that they need to be trained to work in the environment that we've presented our staff with.
So, in other words, what might look at one level like a small technological fix is actually a huge social issue that may require the restructuring of the educational system as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just had a conversation with somebody yesterday at the hospital about the challenges of providing training. You know, hospitals work 24/7, and so you have staff come on, you have to provide them, let's say you have a need to hire casual staff, which is a chronic issue. So, you know, you bring in a new staff person or you bring in somebody on a temp basis, and they fundamentally are constrained in their ability to function on a unit until they've had some minimal degree of training on the hospital computer systems. And It's a huge labor force that you have to sort of provide this continual training for. It's a very big challenge. So, I mean, one of the great lessons from technology assessment is that the impacts of technology there are multiple orders to them. You have primary impacts, you have secondary impacts, you have tertiary impacts, you have quaternary impacts. So it's kind of like a pebble dropping in water and how it makes waves that ascend outward from the pebble. And technological change is exactly the same. So, you know, you introduce the electronic patient record system because you want to create some administrative efficiencies and improve data quality, let's say. And, you know, the second order effect of that is that you have to retrain all of your staff, you have to redesign the spaces into which the computers are introduced. You have organizational change resulting from shifts in the distribution of work between different groups resulting from the technology and so on. So it's really a very complicated set of processes.
This kind of leads up to a question I was thinking you might be willing to address, which has to do with the projected outsourcing of maintenance of the records for the entire provincial and Canadian healthcare system. And I know from listening to CJSF that there is, for instance, a petition asking that the healthcare records management not be privatized to a U.S. company, which would then put all that data in the hands of somebody outside of the country and who might not even be subject to the same laws and so forth. But I'm wondering about this tendency to outsourcing to larger and larger companies. If it doesn't start at the hospital records computerization level, and if this is intended to be a synchronization that then can lead to
management from a single point source somewhere else?
Another excellent question. And before I talk about that specific case, I think it is worth pointing out that this isn't the first time that has come up as an issue, that in the province of British Columbia, we have something called FarmNet. And what FarmNet does is every time you go to your local drugstore and get a prescription filled, the pharmacist has access to all of your medication records. And that was by request of the government. The government actually some years ago asked, required in fact, the pharmacists to buy into a pharmacy system that would allow this to happen. And it was an interesting situation because the government at the time gave each pharmacy $3,000 to go out and buy equipment. And all the pharmacists said, well, $3,000 doesn't begin to cover the cost of the equipment that we need to be able to do this. And it, part of what the pharmacy system does is it also handles your, you know, reporting to MSP, and it handles your, you know, extended health insurance billing if you're lucky enough to have that, and so on. So the FarmNet system does a bunch of different things. And so the pharmacists, you know, they had to invest in this technology, and it was kind of, you know, they weren't necessarily real happy about it because it cost them money. And the other thing that is worth putting on the table here is that the Canadian health system produces a data set that is of interest to pharmaceutical companies as well as to medical researchers really throughout the world. And it's partly because we have a kind of closed system, if you like. We have good health data. So lots of people, particularly south of the border, are really, really interested in our health data. And so it's been on the table before with FarmNet that people have wanted access to our health data. And with FarmNet, one of the things that happened was the pharmacist asked if they could sell the data that they collected to U.S. companies that would use it for basically direct marketing to people and marketing back to us. And it went to the BC legislature and it was turned down. BC legislature ruled that that was not a permissible activity, and the pharmacists, though required to collect that data, were not in fact allowed to sell it for those purposes. So I think that's important to know, just in terms of, I think it gives us a ray of hope in a sense. The other thing that's important to kind of put on the table about that is we have recent federal privacy legislation as well as provincial privacy legislation, both of which would kick in any any effort to outsource of health records data. Having said that, I have to say that I'm remarkably skeptical about, because I've been around computer science worlds for a long time, we tend to gloss over the skill required to do something like type a medical record and input data from a medical record. And we know from other applications in computer science where people have tried to move records processing offshore that it's very difficult to have workers who are not immersed in the context where the data are collected process that data, because of that whole issue we talked about earlier with tacit knowledge. There's too much tacit knowledge that is context dependent required to be able to do that. So I think we're much better off keeping our data here, partly because I think it's important for us to keep jobs here. And having said that, I also can say that there's a whole literature documenting problematic attempts to move other kinds of data processing offshore. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if we didn't face similar problems in the movement of health data offshore.
We certainly are seeing it in other fields. I mean, I know that, for instance, legal work has almost all been moved offshore. All my friends who used to work in that, and people who've been working as medical transcriptionists, now some of that is being moved out.
Bangalore, India is one of the places for medical transcription, in fact.
Yeah. And of course, one can't help but notice that a lot of the, that these are jobs that are mainly done by women that are being moved either offshore or through privatization into lower paid categories. Are you seeing, as these kinds of things are being moved out of the immediate context, like the laundry going to another province to be done in order to save money and these kinds of things, I mean, do you see that as something that people also have to adapt to as well as the technology? I mean, does it cause workarounds?
Well, anytime you change the way that work is done, anytime you change the processes, you run the possibility, I mean, you're changing the work organization. And actually, I want to mention another student here, a student named Nikki Kanamui, who's a special arrangements master student, is in fact doing her master's research on the contracting out of laundry services at Vancouver Coastal. And so that's one to stay tuned to for later on. But anytime you change the way work is done, you introduce the possibility that you'll be dealing with an interruption to the work process, which will require either articulation work or workarounds in order to restore the provision of services that's required.
You mentioned several of your students now, and I know that you're teaching some very interesting courses at the university. Would you talk a bit about your course in technology design at Simon Fraser University here, Professor Balka, what kinds of things you have the students do, and what can they do with that after they learn it?
So that course is called Communication and Social Issues in Design. And the history of that course goes something like this. If you take seriously the notion, which has been put forward by several scholars, both one of the people that at the SFU campus will be familiar with is the work of David Noble. And David Noble suggests that social bias is built into technology design. It's an idea that's been picked up by social constructivists, people who take a perspective of technology that it's socially constructed and thus reflects the social values of the society that produces it. And I should take a pause here and mention the work of Maggie Benston. And most people spend a lot of time on this campus and have no idea that Maggie Benston actually was a very, very fabulous person and scholar who worked in this area, and in fact somebody with whom I studied, and who worked with this idea that technology reflects the values of the society from which it's produced. So, anyway, that's just a kind of historic note about Simon Fraser University and the Maggie Benston building. Anyway, if you take seriously this notion that technology reflects the values of the society in which it's produced, I think a logical extension of that is maybe we should try and make that process conscious. So the idea behind Communication and Social Issues in Design is to say, okay, if technology reflects social values of the society in which it's produced, why don't we think about what kinds of values we want to have reflected in the technology and consciously go about trying to introduce those values into the technology so that the technology, in fact, supports the kind of society in which at least I want to live. So what I did is I put together a course that starts out and builds on some of the theoretical work that I've mentioned here, you know, based on notions like social constructivist perspectives of technology, that the design of technology is only fully completed in its use, that plans differ from situated action. So we start out, we review a bunch of theoretical material that provides a kind of foundation for students, and then the course moves in about the third week into a survey of social issues in design. So we talk about how to take gender into account in design. We talk about how to take disability into account in design. We talk about how ethnicity is reflected in design of technology. We talk about how to build green technologies, how to build environmentally sound technologies. So what we do is we run through a whole range of social issues. We talk about designing technology so that it supports rather than impedes occupational health and safety. And what we do is we go through this whole series of topics that I think if we take into account, we'll end up with better technologies. So that's the lecture part of the course. And at the same time, there's a process that goes on in the lab. Students are put into multidisciplinary teams at the beginning of the term. I canvass the campus community and get the campus community, as well as usually the nonprofit community outside of the university, to come up with technology design problems they have where they either need a problem solved or they need a technology redesigned. And the different groups in the class are each given a technology design problem, and their task over the course of the semester is to solve it. And I take the class in the lab through a series of exercises that helps them build and develop the skills that allow them to go out and solve the problem. And so one of the projects, for example, that students from Communication and Social Issues and Design worked on is the redesign of the library common space to, people know, I think, that that recently the first floor, I believe, of the library was redesigned, and that was a project for that class. And so, for example, just building on that, students needed to figure out how other students used the library and what times of day the library was used by what kinds of people and for what kinds of tasks and what kinds of problems students ran into and so on. And they had to go out and they had to collect all this information, which they did by talking to the people who use the library. And they had to figure out what kinds of, what role the new space should fill and so on. So it's a great course. It's a very practical course. It teaches people how to do field work. Students have parlayed work from that course into going into usability work in computing and related technology industries. We've actually had a couple of students who have done really well professionally, building on stuff they learned in that course. And that course, I should also say, is a kind of unique course in that it's one of the only courses, if not the only course, in the Faculty of Applied Sciences that students in all of the schools within the Faculty of Applied Sciences can sign up for and get credit towards their degree. So it doesn't matter if you're in engineering, computer science, communication, or kinesiology, for example, all of those degree programs will grant you credit for that course as part of your degree program. So that's something else I'm quite proud of.
Well, it certainly shows the necessity of this kind of understanding. I would think that it crosses that many disciplines, and it reinforces what you said about being a translator of one kind of work to another kind of work. You mentioned in passing in your course description that there might be differences in how people use technology because of ethnicity. I was wondering if you might elaborate on that a little bit for our listening audience.
Sure. I'm going to pick on one of my staff members, actually, in relation to that. I recently hired a former student of mine, and we were discussing cooking one day. And he's a Chinese-Canadian, and he pointed out that he would never buy a house that didn't have two kitchens. And I was shocked by this. And he explained to me that it was important in his life to have two kitchens because the diet that he eats, which is a largely Chinese food diet, involved a lot of probably wok cooking. We didn't get into what he actually cooked with, but he said, I like to have two kitchens because I have one kitchen that I only do my frying in, and I just shut that kitchen off, and I don't have to deal with the, you know, grease or whatever from my fried foods in any place else in the house. I just go in my one kitchen that I have for fried food, and then my other kitchen I do all my other work in. So that's an interesting, I use that as an example only because it shows how one's activities are often linked to one's ethnic background, in this case cooking. I have entirely different cooking habits. And because my cooking habits and my colleagues' cooking habits different, are differ. We have a need for a different spatial organization of our houses. We probably use different implements with which to cook, and so on. So that's kind of a simple example. There are lots of other examples that I could give you. We know that people from different ethnic backgrounds, for example, have different attitudes towards their physical bodies, right? We know that women from certain backgrounds are very reluctant to have pap smears, and that probably has an impact on how they interact with certain kinds of technology in hospital settings.
Professor Ellen Balka, founder and director of the Assessment of Technology in Context Design Lab at Simon Fraser University in Canada. We spoke at Campus Radio CJSF in 2004. Today she's partly retired from teaching and does consulting. Her current project is a simple-to-use system for pharmacists to report and prevent repeats of adverse drug reactions. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our website at wingsradio.org/wordpress. We also share news at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, host of a series of Zoom salons at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, we feature an interview with Ken Lee, co-founder of Lotus Foods. This interview is produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly show featuring interviews about the future of food farming and public health. Listen now as host Teresa Marquez introduces Ken Lee.
I am Teresa Marquez, and I'm here today with Ken Lee. Ken, together with his wife Carol Levine, founded Lotus.